Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you all back to the second session of this conference today. I'm Fiona Hill, the Director of the Centre on the United States and Europe. And before I begin, there's just a couple of logistical things that I want to run through because our schedule is a little tight today. First of all, I actually wanted to also mention, as Ken Pollock did, that this is a joint venture of sorts, this event, not just with the with the Centre on the United States and Europe and the Saban Centre, but also with our arms control initiative here at Brookings that my colleague Steve Pfeiffer runs. And as a result of that, we also should obviously say a word of thanks to some of the people who have made this and some of the research that surrounded this event possible. The Carnegie Corporation of New York that's provided some funding for looking at the way that the United States and its allies and other countries are dealing with global challenges, obviously Iran being one of those rising power issues. And also funding that we've got from the MacArthur Foundation and Plowshares for work on arms control and non-proliferation. And this, obviously, Iran is one of the critical issues for this. The other thing that I wanted to mention is that immediately after this session, we're going to break for a buffet lunch. Now, seeing as there are so many of us, I want to avoid a stampede to the door. So, and lunch is always a very important thing. And if lunch, for some reason, hasn't proliferated sufficiently, to use the pun of the moment, there's also our cafeteria next door, which, of course, isn't free. But in any case, for those of you who can't face the stampede for the sandwich board, there's always the Brookings cafeteria. And they're doing a survey in there right now, so... I'm going to make a plug for continuing Brookings cafeteria service. We also, because we're having Tom Donilon, the National Security Advisor, come to give the keynote when lunch is finished, as you can imagine, there's going to be a little bit of reshuffling for security, and he will have a few people with him. So we'll actually need to move some seating around at the front. Sorry to the people who are currently sitting at the front. So that will happen during lunch. And because of security considerations, we all need to be back in our chairs again at 12:50. For Mr. Donilon coming in. So I just wanted to say that in advance because I know everyone will have a sandwich on their mind at the end of the session. Now, the purpose of this session is to cover many of the issues that were already raised by some of you in the audience, which is really what has been the role of the United States allies and other partners in dealing with the situation of Iran. We already had questions about the role of Europe, the European Union, and some of the individual countries of Europe in their interactions with Iran. We already had some comments on how the role of Europe and the European Union has shifted. And we have with us today François Rivesseau, who is the deputy head of the delegation of the European Union here in Washington, D.C., to help us think through some of these issues. François also has had a very distinguished career in the French Foreign Ministry. He was also the deputy head of the French delegation here in Washington before he took up his current position with the European Union. And in that capacity, he's also, in fact, worked directly on the issue of Iran. He was French ambassador to the Geneva Conference on Disarmament and Non-Proliferation Issues in the mid-2000s, where he was, in fact, involved directly in negotiations with Iran at Geneva. And he's also worked on disarmament issues and advisor to UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. So François has a broader perspective on this in the European context. We also had questions about Russia and whether Russia will continue to play its role in the sanctions issue. Of course, Russia has played a very prominent role in Iran with the Russian involvement in the Bushehr nuclear reactor, the civilian nuclear reactor, which has been a focal point of people's attention, and also in the run-up to the latest, most recent sanctions resolution, and the big question of whether Russia would actually send advanced air defence capability to Iran, the S-300 missile system, which would, of course, have enabled Iran to potentially fend off any kind of military action against its nuclear program. And to talk about the Russian aspects of this, we have John Parker with us. John is currently a senior researcher at the National Defense University in the National Institute for Strategic Studies, but he has a long and distinguished career at the State Department. He has been a senior analyst and director and deputy director of various research programs related to Russia at the at State's INR, the Intelligence and Research Bureau. And John is also the author, quite recently, of a book on Russia-Iranian relations that has taken a look at the depth of this long-standing and sometimes contentious relationship between Russia and Iran, and touched upon some of the issues that we're looking at today. So John is well positioned to be able to talk to some of the questions that were already raised in the audience about Russia. And then last but certainly not least, we have Yun Sun, who is currently a visitor here at the CNAPS program, the Center for North East Asian and Pacific Studies here at Brookings. Yun is from China and most recently was working for the International Crisis Group in Beijing. She's an expert on Chinese national security decision-making. That's some of the work that she is looking at here at Brookings. And clearly she has on-the-ground expertise on China and hopefully can address some of the issues that were already raised about China's role, China's attitudes towards the sanctions regime, and also whether China may use, as the question from the student from George Washington University suggested, whether China might use the Iran card given some of the broader security thinking going on in China now in response to developments in the South China Seas or in East Asia and Southeast Asia. A particular thorny set of questions, and these are the kinds of things that Yun has been looking at for some time. So we'll start, first of all, as we've done in the other panel, with a brief overview from our panellists, and then we'll turn it over to you for questions and answers, and perhaps they can pick up on some of the issues that were already raised. So, François, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Fiona. Thank you, all of you. It's a fascinating subject, about Iran, and if I may say so, one of a structuring subject of international life of the last years. We have been asked to reflect about how to maintain international unity around Iran for the future. Indeed, we have had till now a lot of international unity about what had to be done, and what could be done, and what has been done. So it is just legitimate that we look at lessons learned first, on the substance, and then maybe I will briefly touch on the proceedings. On the substance, I think the first lessons learned is that when you want to keep international unity, you have to build a case, and you have to build it seriously. And you have to build it patiently, although sometimes it takes time, but if you want to get international unity, you have to to do it as fast as possible, knowing that it takes time. Let me just read one para which indicates you the conclusions we can achieve. Information indicates that Iran has carried out the following activities that are relevant to the development of a nuclear explosive device. Efforts, some successful, to procure nuclear-related and dual-use equipment and materials by military-related individual entity. Effort to develop undeclared pathways for the production of nuclear material. Acquisition of nuclear development information and documentation from clandestine nuclear supply networks, and work on development of indigenous design of nuclear weapons, including the testing of components. You have recognized one of the conclusions of the last IAEA report. That's how you build a case. That's how you get, contrary to former cases at the beginning of the century, that's how you build a case which is undisputable or difficult to dispute. And that's the first way of doing it. As long as we shall be able to maintain this path and to build upon credible, internationally accepted information, then although it's painful, long, and difficult, we shall, in my view, be able to keep international unity. And it will be up to my two panelists to assess that, but I'm confident that this will go further than keeping the EU with US. It will keep the international community along. The second thing is, when you have built your case, how to present the case. And it's very important when you present the case that you present the case according to standards of international law. Everything which goes completely out of international law is necessarily breaking the international unity, the unity of international community. If you want to keep the unity, you have to stick to international law. Obviously, international law can be interpreted, but we know since at least 2003 that there are limits to the way you can twist interpretations. You have to interpret to stick to the international law and to stick to to generally accepted interpretations of its international law. We know that in the US there are very good lawyers, and we know that some lawyers can achieve conclusions which are somehow very different of each other. We have to stick also with the mainstream of international law if we have to keep international unity. If I may add one thing, sticking to international law doesn't prevent nations to act. And if you look at what has been done on Iran, you will see that we have had a number of resolutions, six from the UN, if I remember well the list. Yes, six of the UN, the last one in 2010. But we had also nation-based measures. The US, you know, took some in 2008, took others in 2010, took recently some others, as recently as last week. But the US has not been alone to act on a national basis. Some European countries have even acted on their own, and the EU, as such, on the 26th of July of 2010, has taken a number of measures, ranging from interdiction of travel to prohibiting assistance, technical assistance of technological transfer for oil refinery of gas liquefaction, added a number of banks and of people prohibited to travel. And what I want to insist on that is that on that the EU has not only gone much further than what the UN was obliging us to do, but also in a number of areas much farther than everybody else, including the United States. So, when you want to act, you can act. And you have noticed, for example, that between yesterday and this morning, the British Prime Minister about the Iranian Central Bank, the French President of the Republic about oil sales, have also taken very radical positions, which goes far, but on a national basis. So when you want to act, you can always propose or even implement measures which goes very far on a national basis, and this is consistent with international law, and so we should not feel too much paralyzed by international law. The last element of substance, in my view, is to once you have built the case and presented the case, you have to check at options. What are the best options? And here I will express to you the convictions I forged since 8 years when I am on this file. There is no better way available to the international community than the present one. That's it, to go for strengthening sanctions, making every year, ideally every month, the cost of this nuclear program, which is illicit, because it is, it has, and you know why it is illicit, it's not per se, it is because it has no other possible final goal than a military one, because there's no civil conceivable goal for this program. So it is illicit, we have to maintain the point, and we have to make the cost of this illicit program more and more expensive for Iran, so that at a certain point, the Iranian nation, the Iranian people, I don't know for the Iranian leaders, because this is a very difficult question, but at some point Iran, which is a great nation, will realize that its best interest is to cooperate with the international community instead of choosing, as I think some European leaders said yesterday and this morning, choosing to go its path alone, to choose isolation. At one point, we want to make sure that Iran realizes that its interest is to avoid isolation. And if you look at the other options, because there are obviously other options, and some have to remain on the table just for the sake of being there, but that said, if you look at using them, you will see that a correct assessment makes no other option available. So I think this is also... you have also to choose the option which is the most, not only the only available, but the most commonly seen as the only one possible. On procedure, very quickly, you know that maintaining the unity of the international community is difficult. It has involved historically in-depth regular contact each 3 months between, initially at the heart of a reflection, you have what we call the EU-3, That is France, UK, and Germany, and US. And some initiatives came from US Treasury, some initiatives came from France, some initiatives came from London, sometimes also from Berlin, and then usually they are discussed within the EU3 and with the US, and in a sort of choreography, which varies also not only for, is not completely specific, can vary depending the timing, but is essential that there is a unity of views which is progressively emerging at this level. But at the same time, you cannot do that only within this framework. You had from start and from the very beginning to associate discussion with Russia and with China, because if you discuss without them, or if you solidify a US-EU-free position without China and Russia, you are likely to face a strong opposition. So the choreography was trying to get the feeling where we are going, but associating very early China and Russia, ideally right from scratch, sometimes not exactly right from scratch, because when you have an idea coming out, you first discuss it with within EU and US, but before solidifying them and giving it a real form and shape, discussing it in the P5 context. And with EU authorities also, because as you know, the EU3 discussion involves also the presence of a representative of EU, and today Lady Ashton. And as you know, this process has conducted the EU3 plus 3, as we name them, to give mandate to Lady Ashton to discuss with the UN authority, because another procedural need is to always keep the two tracks approach, which is one track, which is the sanctions and making the price of this nuclear program every day higher, ideally. But on the other hand, demonstrating to Iran that we would they choose to cooperate with the international community, the door would be therefore opened. And this is also a demonstration which has to be done periodically. Sometimes it's difficult to do, because you don't you think that you are completely losing your time in trying to remind that to Iran. But you should always know that you are not reminding it only to Iran. You are reminding it to the rest of the world. And it is a condition for keeping the rest of the world aligned with the sanctions that this demonstration is regularly remade. And it should not be seen as a proof of weakness, but it should be taken for what it is. One of the tools we have to keep international unity on this file. If I may, in conclusion, just add, because I think I arrive at the time of concluding, I think there are some methods of contact and negotiation which still could be used additionally to get slightly more efficiency to the system, which we could still do slightly more efficiently the things, but obviously it's time-consuming. But I think there are sometimes I feel that a number of European countries, the ones who are not participating in the EU3 plus 3, are frustrated not being associated, and I think we should keep that in mind and maybe make some provision to discuss with them, not only bilaterally but as a group. And I think the international community at the level of UNGA, also you have the main states, we discuss with them, we discuss with Brazil, we discuss with the BRICS, we discuss with some important players such as Turkey or Nigeria, Egypt, South Africa, Brazil, whatever. But when you are, for example, Peru or Thailand, you would like also to be associated, as we have seen in the example of Malaysia, for example. Malaysia, you know, for those who know, was part of the story of the UNE file, and at a certain point, it would certainly have been good to be able to talk a bit earlier with Malaysia. So there are things still that we can do to enlarge and widen the consensus on what we are doing, but I'm pretty sure that we shall continue working on that. Thank you.
Thank you very much, François. And John, your thoughts on the Russian perspective?
Yeah, thanks, Fiona. And also, thank you very much for inviting us all to participate in this panel and for your very gracious introduction. There have already been questions on Russia that were raised during the first panel. So I may take a couple minutes longer to answer those and go beyond my 7 to 8 minutes. I always have to start out with a disclaimer. I am a U.S. government employee, but my comments this morning are my own. They don't represent the views of the National Defense University or the Department of Defense or even the U.S. government. Also, what I'm trying to do this morning is not to debate the Russian position, but to lay it out to you as objectively as I can, so that you understand where Russia is coming from and what the potentials are to move forward with Russia in a unified way on this process dealing with the Iranian nuclear issue. So as I see it from Moscow's perspective, international unity on Iran has just gone through a rough patch that was both unnecessary and not of Moscow's own making, but is still salvageable. Moscow was quite comfortable with the situation that had developed since the Security Council adopted Resolution 1929 in June 2010. 1929's tough sanctions, which Moscow added to with its breaking of the S-300 contract, had gotten Tehran's attention. After that, Moscow's no new sanctions stand, which Foreign Minister Lavrov first pronounced in February of this year, and Moscow's quote-unquote step-by-step approach, which Lavrov rolled out in July, and that Moscow claimed to have coordinated with its P5 plus one partners, allowed Moscow to do several things at one time. One, maintain the pressure of Resolution 1929's sanctions on Iran. Two, take the lead within the P5 plus one on step-by-step overtures to Iran. And three, repair Moscow's own bilateral relations with Tehran, badly frayed since Resolution 1929 and the S-300 decision. So against this background, Moscow's furious reaction over the early release and the furious spin given the November 8th IAEA report was no mere bargaining ploy, but it really reflected genuine annoyance and some anger. Moscow saw the calls for more sanctions in the aftermath of the disclosure of the alleged plot, Iranian plot, against Saudi Ambassador Adel al-Jubeir in Washington, in the aftermath of the chatter in Israel over a military strike against Iran's nuclear program, and in the aftermath of the IAEA report itself and its unusual kind of premature disclosure. I don't think it was ever put out as early as it was this time. Moscow really saw all of this as undermining Moscow's lead on step-by-step and confronting Russia with the choice of either support more Security Council resolutions now or soon countenance an Israeli strike on Iran. Now, just to be clear on Moscow's view of the Iranian threat, although the Russian Foreign Ministry accused the IAEA report what it said was juggling with information in order to create an impression that the Iranian nuclear program allegedly has a military component. The Russian leadership and most Russian experts have no illusions on this score. In July 2010, for example, President Medvedev quite clearly stated that it is obvious that Iran is coming close to the possession of potential that could, in principle, be used to create nuclear weapons. Just last Friday, Russian Defense Minister Anatoly Serdyukov told the press that Russia wants to continue leasing the Kabbalah radar in Azerbaijan and intends to upgrade it. Enhancing the capacity of Kabbalah, Serdyukov said, is useful and very important, in particular, given the Iranian missile program. And the same day, materials prepared for a report by General Nikolai Makarov, chief of the general staff, reportedly included the buildup of Iran's nuclear potential among developments that could draw Russia's armed forces into a future conflict. Nonetheless, from what I can tell, most Russian experts do not believe that the most recent IAEA report presents serious new grounds for imposing another round of sanctions against Iran at this time. They did not have to be persuaded that Iran has been engaged in a military nuclear program for some years. But at the same time, they believe it will still take more than several years for Iran to be truly nuclear capable. On VOA last Thursday, for example, Vladimir Sajin of the Oriental Institute in Moscow gave as good a guesstimate as any. He said that it would be 5 to 7 years, take 5 to 7 years, for Iran to marry a workable warhead with a capable missile, as long as there weren't any outside interference. And, of course, there's always interference. One expert believes that Iran will probably stop dealing with the IAEA only when it has overcome all technical problems and has all the inputs necessary to produce a bomb and a delivery vehicle. In the meantime, the view of most Russian experts is that continuing IAEA control of Iran's nuclear program, however imperfect this control, is more important than how much uranium Iran continues to enrich, and that it is therefore crucial for the international community not to do anything precipitous that might cause Iran to bolt from the IAEA and put an end to any chance for a negotiated solution. So for these reasons, Moscow is clearly pleased with the P5+1 decision, after all, not to go forward with another sanctions draft at this time. At the same time, given all the publicity in the run-up to the IAEA meeting, Moscow is now probably more concerned than ever over the possibility of an Israeli strike on Iran. In Moscow's view, an Israeli strike at this time could not put an end to the Iran nuclear program, but would for sure mean Iranian abandonment of the NPT. Moreover, there would be unforeseen consequences ranging from a regional war to a regional nuclear arms race. This matter of ruling out the threat of force against Iran is an old issue for Russia. Russia doesn't have a problem with putting more pressure on Iran as long as it is twinned with engagement and not the threat of force and isolation. When the Security Council passed its first resolution on the Iranian nuclear program, Moscow made sure it excluded any Chapter 7, Article 42 threat of force. And Russia has been consistent on this point over the years. And the subsequent resolutions on Iran have all been bounded by the original resolution's non-invocation of Article 42. Nevertheless, Russia really has very little confidence that keeping Article 42 out of Security Council resolutions on Iran will in the end restrain especially Israel if it decides to go ahead and strike Iran. And to Moscow's own frustration and I would say regret, Russia's help to Iran in the Security Council has not deterred Iran from inviting precisely such a strike by continuing to move ahead with its nuclear and missile programs. Now, on a different point, in criticizing the IAEA's latest report, Foreign Minister Lavrov claimed some movement by Iran toward the IAEA in recent weeks and criticized the IAEA report for not mentioning it. But the history of Iranian maneuvering suggests that this is just another instance of Iran flashing enough leg to encourage Moscow to fend off pressure from the U.S. and the other P5+1 powers. Nevertheless, Moscow can now tell Tehran, we saved you this time from another round of Security Council sanctions, but you have to move or we will not be inclined to do so again next March. Yes, Moscow, for the record, has already criticized the additional financial and energy sanctions that the United States and its allies are announcing this week as illegal and unacceptable. But I suspect that part of Moscow quietly does not really mind that these so-called unilateral sanctions up the ante on Iran. And in fact, many Russian companies add to the pressure by deciding not to do any business with Iran that might run afoul of these unilateral Western sanctions. Moreover, some longtime Russian observers of Iran have concluded that sanctions, in fact, are having some impact though not necessarily directly, on Iran's nuclear program, and though Iran still has a lot of workaround options that it can explore. On sanctions, finally, Moscow's no new sanctions mantra. Given Moscow's record over the years, Iran can have absolutely no confidence that Russia will not vote for another round of sanctions if Iran continues to frustrate IAEA inspectors, and especially if there are further surprise revelations of Iranian work toward enrichment and weaponization. Now, will Putin's return to the presidency next year change Russia's policy towards Iran in general and on the nuclear issue in particular? Probably not. It was on Putin's first watch that Russia from 2002 to 2006 backed the many IAEA investigations of the Iranian nuclear enrichment program, that Russia in 2006 voted for referral of the issue by the IAEA to the Security Council, and that Russia that same year supported the first of six separate Security Council resolutions on the Iranian nuclear issue. As a dominant partner in Russia's tandem since 2008, Putin has supported Moscow's tougher stance towards Iran since the advent of the reset between the Obama and Medvedev administrations. And from all accounts, Putin has grown to really distrust Ahmadinejad personally and Tehran in general for using Russia to stave off Security Council pressure without giving anything in return. And this is likely to remain in place whoever replaces Ahmadinejad as president in 2013. Nevertheless, the breakthrough ushered in last year by Russia's support for tough sanctions and cancellation of the S-300 contract is not necessarily irreversible. Russian experts warned that Moscow may tilt back towards Tehran in response to a serious fraying in U.S.-Russian reset relations. However, the record suggests to me that any rollback in Russian support for sanctions will depend mostly on whether Iran decides to cooperate more fully with the IAEA in clarifying Iran's nuclear enrichment program and moving towards verifiable restraint and even suspension. Now, on the significance of economic ties, although some observers assert that they will always draw Russia back towards Iran, bilateral trade has always been anemic relative to the size of these two partners. China's trade with Iran is 10 times larger than that of Russia's trade with Iran, and Russia's trade with Iran is not much larger than Russia's trade with Israel, a much smaller country. Everything else being equal, the United States and Russia's European partners will always be more important to Russia than Iran. One last caution, however, and then I'll stop. Moscow's Iran policy accents will always differ from those of Washington and other Western capitals, even if they intersect on some major security points as they do now. Historically, engagement has always been Moscow's default setting for dealing with Tehran, especially on regional issues. Right now, the Arab Spring has pushed forward challenges and opportunities to the positions of both countries in the Middle East. And in South Asia, the impending American withdrawal from Afghanistan has raised the prospect that Russia and Iran may again have to partner closely in resisting the Taliban threats to their equities in the region as they did pre-9/11. Thank you.
Thanks very much, John. That was an interesting point about the trade, but of course China is also a much larger economic power than Russia is. And I wonder how much trade is a factor in the relationship between China and Iran, and perhaps you could touch on that as well.
Absolutely.
The other questions that were already presented from the audience. And thank you again for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me here. I'm going to focus on China's position on the Iran nuclear issue. Some of the issues that I will cover include China's basic positions on Iran nuclear issue, the primary reason for China's reluctance on multilateral sanctions, and then I'm going to talk about how is China going to change its position on the multilateral sanctions from the United Nations. So first of all, China's basic position on Iran nuclear issue has remained largely unchanged in the past few years. if you compare China's official lines on the recent tension over the nuclear issue with the official positions from the last round, from 2009 to early 2010, you will discover that China's position and official statements have remained almost identical. So first of all, on the nuclear development itself, China opposes nuclear proliferation and disapproves of the development of nuclear weapon by any Middle East countries, including Iran. And second, on the resolution mechanism, China strongly opposes the military option and is reluctant to accept a new sanction regime from the United Nations. So from Beijing's point of view, China hopes the nuclear crisis could be settled through diplomatic dialogue and negotiation, and this is always the case. There are plenty of analysis on why China is fixated on this formula. The most compelling one, like Fiona and John just mentioned, is that China has a vested interest in its economic relationship with Iran, especially on the energy. According to the data from Chinese General Administration of Customs, in the first six months of this year, of 2011, Iran was the third largest exporter of crude oil to China, contributing about 10% to China's total import. And China's energy stakes in Iran has been on increase this year. For example, the total volume of oil import from Iran during this period of time increased by 49%. And the LPG import increased by 72%. Also, aside from the energy resources, China is very keen on expanding and diversifying its trade relations with Iran, focusing on the export of Chinese machineries, cars, oil tanks, and on infrastructure projects in Iran. So in 2010, the total bilateral trade approached $30 billion, which is a 40% increase from the previous year. So from these figures, China's reluctance to support harsh multilateral sanctions become rather easy to understand. Sanctions over the oil and petrochemical industries in Iran will have a direct impact over China's thirst for energy. And energy is a key element to fuel the much-needed domestic economic growth to build the legitimacy and to reinforce the legitimacy of Chinese government. Financial sanctions to isolate Iranian banks and financial institutions will further damage China's existing trade relations with Iran. And China's rejection of tough sanctions on Iran is therefore based on a calculation of its own national interest. So will China ever change its position on another round of UN sanctions? The answer is certainly positive. Otherwise, we would not have seen China's support of the previous rounds of UN sanction resolution. China's position on further UN sanctions depends on primarily three factors. First of all, and most importantly, China's attitude towards sanctions is determined by the likelihood of a military conflict as a result of Iran's nuclear program. When China is convinced that Israel and the United States would not be pacified and a war is imminent, China will accept the second best solution and acquiesce to a UN sanction resolution. Although UN sanctions might also limit China's economic relations with Iran, a war in the Middle East will be worse, since it will not only disrupt China's broader oil import from the whole region, but also will drive up the price of the international price for oil and damage China's broader economic and security interests in the region. This perception is reinforced by the case of Libya earlier this year. However, at this current stage, despite the hawkish rhetoric from Israel and other rumors about an impending military confrontation, China is yet to believe that the war is imminent. Chinese analysts do not think that Israel would launch an attack on Iran without the approval from Washington, and they remain convinced that the Obama administration's top priority is domestic economy and finishing up the withdrawals from Afghanistan and Iraq. And more specifically, they also identify that U.S. is still having major differences with some of the European countries and Arab allies over a war against Iran. Therefore, several senior analysts in China, including a prominent professor from China's National Defense University, commented publicly last week that in the near term, the likelihood of a war is rather low. So without the imminent danger of a war, China's position on UN sanctions depend on the extent of the unilateral sanctions the U.S. is willing to pursue and how they might affect China's economic interest in the country. This for China is strictly a cost-benefit analysis. Currently, China sees two types of possible sanctions the U.S. might adopt that will affect China. One is on Iran's financial institutions, and the other one is on the Iran's petrochemical industry. So for China, the task here is to determine whether the cost to China by these unilateral sanctions will exceed the cost of a multilateral UN sanction, which China will have a role in participating to determine the specifics. The two issues on the top of Beijing's list are restrictions on the business operations of Chinese banks in the U.S. as a result of the U.S. sanction, and the restrictions over Chinese oil companies on their collaborations with and investment in the United States. The complication here lies in the U.S. calculation. Given the extensiveness and the magnitude of U.S.-China relations and China's overall economic importance for the United States, it would be extremely difficult to carve out and implement a sanction regime that would sufficiently and meaningfully punish key Chinese players without hurting U.S. itself or jeopardizing the broader picture of bilateral relations. That, of course, is a cost-benefit analysis that Washington will have to make. Certainly, another factor that impacts China's response is Russia's position. China sees isolation in the Security Council as something to be strictly avoided. Although it usually abstains from UN Security Council decisions it doesn't like, it is generally unwilling to use its veto if Russia backs a certain resolution. Given their common interest in non-intervention and limiting American unilateralism, the positions of Russia and China have traditionally been mutually complementary. Of Beijing's 7 vetoes on the Security Council, 4 were cast together with Russia. That include on Myanmar in 2007, on Zimbabwe in 2008, and most recently on Syria last month. And before the UN Security Council Resolution 1929 on Iran was passed last year, Beijing's opposition to the sanction only began to shift after Russia agreed to cooperate with the West. So these factors determine that any change to China's current rejection of another round of UN sanctions will not happen fast. For China, there's ample ground for more diplomatic talks, regardless of their outcome and results. The IAEA resolution last Friday did not refer the issue to UN Security Council, and it supports diplomatic solution. So for now, China sees the first priority is for Iran to cooperate with IAEA, just like Russia's position, to clarify related concerns raised in the IAEA report. And most likely, from Chinese point of view, Iran will cooperate with IAEA, but to a certain extent, to cope with international pressure. But on the other hand, for China, Russia's criticism of the IAEA report was extremely harsh, indicating a change of position from Moscow would neither be easy nor fast. So according to a senior Chinese analyst from the China Academy of Social Sciences over the weekend, the situation will have to brew faster or intensify more before China would make any change to its position, and this will not happen overnight. Lastly, I'm going to talk a little bit about China's position on Iran's nuclear program. People might question China's commitment to nuclear non-proliferation, given its very carefully calculated response out of its own national interest. To be fair, China is sincere when it says it opposes nuclear proliferation. As a nuclear power, China doesn't want to see its privileged status diluted by more members into the nuclear club. And Chinese analysts also made the comment such as smaller powers are not as responsible as big powers in their nuclear development. However, it is also true that Beijing has other competing interests coming to the issue of Iran, and non-proliferation is only one of them. Beijing doesn't see Iran's nuclear program constituting a direct or imminent threat to China's national security. This is also why China would like to consider Iran nuclear issue under the broader framework of U.S.-China relations, and use China's advantageous position as a policy leverage against the United States. Many officials and analysts in China are convinced of Iran's nuclear ambition, and they are quite sympathetic about it, given Iran's security concerns and the national pride issue. However, they do make a clear distinction between nuclear ambition and nuclear capacity. Few in China today believe that Iran has come close to producing its own nuclear bomb or developing a reliable delivery system. As for China's perception of the Western intentions on Iran, China is deeply suspicious. Their comment basically is, if the West is truly committed to nuclear non-proliferation, then why haven't they done anything about Israel's nuclear weapon? And this is just a double standard. And why did the United States enter a nuclear deal with India? Neither Israel nor India has even signed on NPT, so at least Iran is a signatory country of non-proliferation treaty. So the natural conclusion here is the West allows its friends to develop nuclear weapons, but not its enemies. Hence, the sanction proposals are often viewed with a lot of suspicion in Beijing that they are ultimately aimed at regime change, not necessarily nuclear non-proliferation. China's suspicion of the West, including the United States, goes deeper and broader than just non-proliferation and Iran. Some Chinese analysts commented that U.S. cooking up the Iran nuclear issue at this sensitive time only because Obama administration needs some achievement on Iran for his re-election campaign. And some even link the current tension on Iran to the desire of Washington to boost its arms sales in Middle Eastern countries to rescue its domestic economy. And there are some more extremists in China who are firm believers of American conspiracy, and they argue that this current tension over Iran is basically a U.S. plot to sabotage Chinese economy by heating up the tension and driving up the international oil price. So these are pretty much the views from Beijing. I look forward to the discussion and any feedback that you might have. Thank you.
Yes, well, thank you very much, Ian. There seems to be quite a bit of parallel thinking in terms of cunning plots on the part of the U.S. in both China and in Russia. I think we can see quite a bit of similarity there in the way that both of these countries factor in the Iran issue into their overall relations with the U.S. But I wonder how much they pay attention. I know Russia certainly pays quite a lot of attention to the views of the European Union and to European countries. For China, is that a factor at all of the thinking of other states and the fact that the European Union has been much more forward-leaning in the last several years on the issue of Iran? Does that get their attention at all, or is that somewhat disregarded? Does China think at all about Europe when it's factoring in Iran?
China certainly thinks about the position from European Union and European countries on the issue of Iran, but I wouldn't say that it constitutes a primary concern for China's position. So China would like to coordinate with UK, France, and Germany, because they are all members of the P5+1, on positions engaging Iran, but it's not a primary focus of China's foreign policy on this issue.
I mean, that's quite a contrast, though, with Russia, because yeah. Certainly in the run-up to 1929, the Russians' attention was grabbed by the fact that Germany, for example, not just the EU, was pushing very hard on the sanctions. And, of course, there's a lot more trade with Germany and the EU for Russia than there certainly is with Iran.
Yeah, and now I think, again, Russia plays it both ways. It criticizes the so-called unilateral non-Security Council sanctions as illegal and unnecessary. At the same time, I think that when it draws Tehran close, it says, see, look at what you're facing. There's nothing we can do about that. And then thirdly, Russian companies are not forced by the Russian government to contravene these sanctions either. There are lots of reports of Russian companies under official Russian government auspices, various bilateral working groups, et cetera, having all of these discussions over deals, but these discussions just go on for years and just are rarely consummated by actual deals. And some of the oil companies just say flat out, yeah, we'd like to do business in Iran, but you know, we don't want to run into trouble contravening sanctions.
Mm-hmm. So. François, I mean, I was going to ask you, I mean, how can Europe deal with China in this context? In some regards, there's already the political dialogue going on with Russia here, but having heard what Yun said, I mean, what are your reactions to this?
I very much agree with what both have said. But there is another angle to that, which is that Europe is not a security main problem for China, as China is not a main security problem for Europe for the time being. This has its good aspects, which are that, it's maybe because Europe is seen as less problematic for Russia and China that it has been chosen to be the representative of P5 plus one or U3 plus three to Iran. It's not by mistake that it's Lady Ashton and not Hillary Clinton or Mr. Lavrov who have Chinese representative who have been chosen to engage with Iran. So, here we are in complementary role. We are a bit like we were at the EU free time, also in charge of engaging with Iran. We are still faithful to to this aspect of the mission. You need somebody in the international community who does that. And although in terms of security, I agree very much, we are not so much a factor. In terms of economy, nevertheless, the economic relation with between Europe and not only Iran, but also the economic environment of Iran are by far the most important. So, here you have also an element because economic sanctions taken by the European Union are probably more important than sanctions taken by any other entity when it regards the impact of the Iranian economy. So, all in all, I think we are different players with different cards to play.
That's a very good point. Let me turn over now to the audience. We'll take a quick round of questions for you. The gentleman from the Iranian. Yes, the mic's coming down here. Thank you.
Hi, Ardavan Naimi from the National Iranian American Council. This question's for Mr. Francois. You were speaking on the tightening of sanctions by the international community and how they're essentially the only practical method to move forward. And you mentioned other options on the table for the sake of being on the table. Can you talk about these other options and why they're bankrupt? Thank you.
Yes, let's just can we take another question? Yes, at the very back, the lady in the back row here. Thank you.
Hello, this is Soyu. Thank you. I'd like to thank you, the panelists, for your insight. I'd like to ask a quick question on North Korea, which is another very heavily sanctioned country. The new multilateral sanctions on Iran, I'd like to hear how it's going to impact the sanctions on North Korea, and especially when there are a lot of news media reports on the nuclear cooperation between Iran and North Korea. Also, I'd like to ask what will be the impact of Iranian sanctions on North Korea, especially with Russia and China focusing their efforts on Iran? Like, will it shift the focus? Like, will it undermine the gravity of the situation in North Korea and their and its nuclear program, or will it help focus international communities focus on such issues?
Thanks. That's a very good question. A lady over here in the red sweater, over at the back. There we
go. Thank you. Anne Penketh from BASIC, British American Security Information Council. As you know, the Obama administration and even the Israelis frame the Iranian problem as a global problem and one which they say requires global solutions. Now, I understand, obviously, the impact of the EU on the Iranian economy, but the fact is that this latest round is unilateral. So I'm just wondering to what extent it might be a problem going forward with the perception that it's the West versus Iran rather than the whole world?
Thanks. That's also a very good question here. Perhaps, Francois, you could begin with responding to this question about the global dimension. You yourself in your presentation had mentioned the need to engage with other countries. Malaysia was one country that you had put forward, and you talked about some of the ways in which European countries that are not included in the EU3 wanted to have more of a role here. And as our colleague from BASIC was pointing out, this perception that there's just a Western, but really a US and European endeavour, could be very much harmful to the principles that you laid out about presenting the case and keeping unity.
Yes. Maybe I shall start with this question, then I shall go to the second question. I very much agree with what you said from BASIC. There is a risk that going, and that's the limitation and the risk of going for Western sanction unilaterally, that not that it is seen as illegal, because they are not illegal, they are national, they are not, it's not trying to impose a unilateral embargo by force, they are just things which are within the framework of national legislations. But that could indeed fuel the feeling that it's the West who leads the offensive, and that then the other can safely stay on the side. And that's precisely what we have also to avoid. So we have to keep a balance between both the need of taking new measures and keeping the rest of the world engaged. There is an element which goes also a bit as an answer on the timing of the sanctions, which was in the first question raised. If you look at the timing, you see that it takes more and more time between each UN Security Council to achieve. You had two in 2006, then 2007, 2008, then 2010. If we were pessimistic and believing in the law of series, we would say that the next sanction is probably not to arrive before beginning 2013 at the UN level, which is consistent with the initial reactions of both Russia and China. That said, that's a risk. The only consequence I draw from it is that we have to be continually engaging with the rest of the international community, not going too far on the national of a national sanctions front, because then it demobilizes the other, and trying to fuel the kind of reflection that you were alluding to in Beijing. What is the cost of national sanctions for me compared to the top cost of sanctions, UN sanction, a bit less aggressive but more universal? And we have also to make the calculation, and the calculation is in many cases not so easy to make, because there are great advantages also to have a universal cover. So I think this is a true concern we have to keep in mind. On your questions about the other options, I think there are two other options which are have to remain on the table. One I briefly described, which is to keep to show to the rest of the world that the door remains open for Iran, would Iran wish to sincerely re-engage. And as I said, it has to remain on the table, but it has to remain on the table mostly for reasons of principle, because we don't believe, I think, that Iran today is really keen to sincerely re-engage at this stage. The other option opposite is the military option, which has, for a bit symmetrical reasons, to remain also on the table in my personal view, which is that it is very difficult to mobilize really the international community, and particularly Russia and China, if this option is not on the table, because if not, it means that we are not serious and that we are not taking the Iranian situation for what it is, which is one of the major challenges for the world international security, given the situation of Iran in the world and the way this program is conducted. It doesn't mean necessarily either that we believe that there is an immediate probability of this option being used. As I said, when you look concretely at the options, you will see that there are all the serious reasons not to use it at this stage. and that it could be more counterproductive and productive to use it at this stage. Now, there is always a difficulty here, because if you want to be credible, you have also to make the point that it could be used and to explain why. So here also the balance is difficult to draw between keeping it on the table just for the sake of keeping it, or keeping it on the table for the sake of making it a useful tool, and then you have to continue working on it. So I think we have to continue working on it, and it should not be on the table only for demonstration purpose, because if not, it would not serve any purpose. So it has to be there and as a credible tool, a bit as an element of deterrence, and you know that deterrence is useful till the point where you have to use it, where it stopped to be useful. So I think it's a bit of the same logic which should apply here to this military option. It should be maintained credible and used as a deterrence tool, in my view. But don't quote me on that, because this is a purely personal, real personal view of mine. I there are many aspects on that, and I don't pretend to have a last word on that. I'm not a military specialist on that. But these are basically the two options which, in my view, for various reasons, most of you probably better know than me even on that, but in my view have to be made on the table, because if I just stick to my point, which is how to maintain international unity, it is sure that having the two options on these two opposite options, re-engaging on one hand and the military option on the other, have technically helped to build international unity. I will not go further than that, because I would go out of my subject, and it's not up to me to say. But I would say both have proven useful to keep international unity, and that's all what I can say.
Well, I mean, this is the ultimate real question, though, for the purposes of both China and Russia. Clearly, this was a factor in the decision-making, as both of you have pointed out, about the last resolution. There was more credibility the last time around that there might be a strike on the part of Israel. I mean, Russia most classically engaged with the Israelis directly on this. There was the so-called secret visit of Netanyahu to Moscow that wasn't so secret because the Russians leaked it, where there was a discussion behind the scenes about this that actually got the Russians' attention. The Saudis got the Russians' attention. Others got the Russians' attention that there might be larger consequences, so that they stepped up. This time around, the Russians don't seem to believe it. And as Yun has said, neither do the Chinese. So the option on the table looks like, you know, something that they can take or leave. And as Francois is discussing, it's extraordinarily difficult then to make that credible. So we seem to have something of a major deterrence dilemma here, and not one that is really playing in a very productive way into this discussion. And I think the question that we had at the back about North Korea is a very important one. I'd like to put this to both of you here, about China and Russia's own calculations on North Korea. I mean, both as neighbours of North Korea, there has been a real threat of conflict on the Korean Peninsula by both South and North Korea engaging in these questions of credibility about the prospects for military, hardly resolution, but a military phase in the conflict. This has been a real consequence. How much are these kinds of really difficult issues playing into China and Russia's calculations about the broader non-proliferation question? Yun, what do you think about this?
Sure. On the issue of North Korea, I remember two quite striking comments from Chinese analysts on the linkage between the Iran nuclear issue and the North Korea nuclear issue. The first comment that I remember so vividly last year from Beijing was, well, North Korea already has nuclear weapons. And if the international community didn't start a war with North Korea, why would we fight a war against Iran, who doesn't even have nuclear weapons today? I guess that explains part of the reluctance, well, or the refusal for China. It's a position toward against the military option. And the second comment that I remember quite well is some of the Chinese analysts believe that Iran learned an important lesson from North Korea, which is you can develop the capacity, but don't test your bomb. Mm-hmm. Once you test your bomb, you are guilty. There's no way that you can avoid the accusation. But if you just develop the capacity and do not have the nuclear test, then you can enjoy a pretty big room for maneuver. And certainly, North Korea is more important for China because North Korea is on China's border. And after the provocations over Cheongnam incident and the Yangpyeong sighting last year, China sees North Korea has been relatively well-behaved this year. So far, it's almost the end of November. There has not been provocation from
Perhaps
North Korea.
Perhaps you shouldn't have said that yet now. Someone will be listening, will be one tomorrow.
Probably. And next year will be the centennial of Kim Il-sung, and they're going to declare North Korea to be a strong, prosperous nation. So China is seeing that North Korea might have the very large likelihood of adopting economic reform approach, and it will gradually open up. So China's concern over North Korea has actually decreased this year.
More positive on North Korea, potentially.
It's more positive on North Korea, potentially.
Well, what about from the Russian perspective?
I think from the Russian perspective, North Korea is in a different stage, more advanced stage. So it presents different problems than does the Iranian issue. There's still a hope that we can prevail upon Iran not to go fully to weaponization. I mean, that's the hope. My guess, and there's still time from the Russian perspective. One point that keeps getting forgotten in terms of what sparks international unity is what is revealed that's new that Iran is engaged in. And there always are surprises. I have to expect that we're going to have more surprises as we go down the road, and that Iran itself will spark this international unity unless it furiously backpedals and really does start cooperating with the IAEA.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned in your presentation that the Russians were not pleased by the fact that they have not got much out of the relationship, and certainly they were most displeased by the fact that they were caught out completely by Qom.
Yeah, and a lot of that led to 1929. The other thing that we forget is that sanctions really have had an impact on Iran in terms of a desire by some to try to engage the West in negotiations. That's how I read the whole Tehran Research Reactor chapter in all of this. I think that Ahmadinejad tried to use that to develop an opening to Washington, to the P5+1, but then it really fell afoul of Iranian domestic politics. I think he might have tried to revive that idea later on, but again, everybody jumped all over Ahmadinejad, and he may only be recovering from that now. So it's not that sanctions have not pushed Iran towards negotiations. They have pushed Iran towards negotiations over the years. But frequently it's been the domestic political situation in Iran that has made it unsustainable for Iran to engage in these negotiations.
Thanks, John. We had a question from the gentleman at the front. Get the mic here, and then also the gentleman just behind you, Joe, and then you as well. Right here, please.
Chirag Parsi, it's a very interesting conversation. I found the conversation about the choreography of creating international consensus very interesting. But at the end of the day, it's a choreography about coming to consensus on a tactic, sanctions. What is the choreography and the conversations that are being had to actually come to a consensus on what would be an acceptable solution? For instance, France has from the outset been very skeptical about the idea of any enrichment on Iranian soil. Other P5 states have a different perspective. Are we pursuing a consensus on a tactic without having a consensus of what a solution would be? And if so, is this just endless tactics, or is there actually a strategy behind this?
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Very good question. And Joe, to the front here. Yes, please.
Joe Cerenzioni, Plowshares Fund. I would like your opinion from your national perspectives, or the ones you represent. How do you think the U.S. policy has worked so far? How is the Obama administration handled this difficult issue? Has it been a clever combination of engagement and sanctions and sabotage, or have they been so constrained by their own domestic political considerations that they've been unable to carry through fully on any one of the dimensions of this problem?
Thanks. There was a question at the towards the back, and then I'll take some out the front. Gentleman here, Tessa, the gentleman with the glasses. Thank you.
Thank you. Jay Kramer. I'd like to ask Francois if you anticipate that the new sanctions from Britain and France will be adopted throughout the EU.
Throughout
the European Union.
European Union. Okay, I thought you said throughout the Aegean. I thought that can't be quite right. But that, of course, Turkey is a factor here, and it's close to the Aegean, so I thought you maybe had an interesting angle there. So let's go back to the panel. Francois, there was a number of questions there about the choreography that you laid out and whether there's a real strategy there rather than just tactics. There's this larger question about broader adoption throughout the EU. And then I think, you know, what might be a difficult question for John, as you're actually still technically with the US government, but if you can put your Russian hat on, as was requested, about, you know, how the policy US looks from the other vantage point. So Francois, perhaps we'll begin again with you.
The question is good. The strategy initially was suspension. Suspension of the enrichment versus no sanction. This has been the strategy from 2003 till 2005. Since then, as it seemed that Iran was repeatedly refusing and adamantly refusing suspension, I remember one negotiation with the Iranis, you know, and we wanted to put in the informal, we were not authorized to make formal relevé of conclusion. It was June 2005. Say, we want to say that the EU repeated his request for suspension. And then we were at the Iranian delegation. The Iranian delegate spectacularly opened the window and said, if you put that, I have to jump from the window because my instructions, I better die now than to come back to Tehran with that. Then we said, all right, we have a second round of negotiation tomorrow. Then the following day it was in our embassy and we made the meeting at ground level. So we opened the window and we said, now you can jump. And we put it back. Okay. So that was suspension, the objective, and that was the problem. Today was the strategic goal. I think, everything evolves, and if we were not thinking about the kind of situation we have, we would not, it would not be professional. So we are thinking, what should be our goal today? We still officially are on suspension. Now, it is sure that the reflections going around have been, since at least 2 years, focusing in a slightly more broader way, not necessarily from a European or French point of view, as you alluded to, but at least from other quarters of EU3+3, about, in a more broader way, how to make sure that there's no military nuclear program in Iran, which is our purpose. We are, nobody negates the right of Iran to use nuclear energy for civil purposes. Nobody. It's a right they derive from NPT. As long as they are in compliance with NPT, this right is okay. But they are not in compliance with NPT. And in a broader sense of the term, this would be, in my view, the strategic objective. The center is suspension, and there are reflections around about how to make sure that that there is no military program, nuclear military program in Iran. Full point. About the other question, which was about did France and UK sanctions have been anticipated by EU? Yes. The answer is yes. In the 14th of November Foreign Affairs Council of EU, we urge Iran to address international concerns over the nature of its nuclear program through full cooperation with IAEA and by demonstrating readiness to engage seriously in concrete discussions on confidence building steps as proposed by High Representative Lady Ashton of BIF of EU3+3. The Council recalled the latest European Council conclusions, inviting it to prepare new restrictive measures against Iran. The Council will continue to examine possible and new reinforced measures and revert to this issue at its next meeting. And on Monday, 2 days ago, We said the process is ongoing, and EU is examining possible additional measures and will already update its list of entities and individuals at the Council of Ministers, Foreign Affairs Council, on 1st of December as a first step. So the answer was yes. We were not necessarily informed, obviously, of the wording which would be used by British Prime Minister or President of French President of the Republic, but we are working together about what can be done nationally and at EU level. And as you know, we have already taken some additional measures after the Saudi plot. We have also interdicted and submitted to sanctions the five people involved. By the way, Europe had already sanctioned one that the US didn't sanction, so we had only to sanction four. We were in advance of one on that. We are considering new sanctions, yes, and obviously the views expressed by EU member states, as we have seen with France and UK, are elements of this reflection.
Thank you. Yun, on the whole question about U.S. policy, I mean, how effective does it look from the perspective of China?
First of all, China does see that U.S. policy on Iran this time has a certain flavor of being deliberate and intentional, of cooking up the tension. And since the resolution 1929 was just passed last year, China was quite... surprise might be too big a word, that so soon this issue just came back again. And just like Russia, there's quite a sense of anger from the Chinese perspective. And if you look at the comments from Chinese analysts, they do identify a linkage between the IAEA report, which they believe is the creation of Amano. And they also pointed out that in some of the WikiLeaks cables that they have identified, Amano allegedly said that his position is the same as the United States on Iran nuclear issue. So there is a suspicion from China that this current tension was deliberately brought up. So on the issue of acceptable global solution, China's position is this. We agree on the goal. We don't want Iran to have nuclear weapons, but we disagree on the approach. The Western countries want sanction, but China doesn't agree. China wants diplomatic negotiation and dialogue. And a quite funny comment from the Chinese analyst is, you like democracy, right? This is a democracy of international relations. And you could have one opinion and we could disagree. And in the end, we'll negotiate. So for the consensus on the solutions, I think it is exactly because there is no consensus on the solutions that everyone is focusing so much on the tactics. But that is the reality of today's world.
So, I mean, the answer probably then to Joe's question is that the U.S. policy is not seen in the same terms as we're obviously thinking we're laying it out. So it has not been effective from the Chinese perspective because they see something else behind the policy moves at all times.
Yeah, and China always emphasizes these sanctions have not worked to force Iran to give up its nuclear program, and it will not work.
And different is the Russian view?
I think, in general, Moscow has been pretty pleased with Washington's Iran policy since the Obama administration came in. And it's only been in the last 6 weeks, well, really since the surfacing of this alleged plot against the Saudi ambassador. After that, the early surfacing of the IAEA report that Moscow has been unhappy with what we're doing. The feeling I get is they thought that they were being rolled without being consulted. The Russian Foreign Ministry statement almost flat out said that. Somebody's out there to undermine Russia's role in this whole process. By the time Obama and Medvedev met in Honolulu, they seemed to smooth things out. And then I think Russia got a IAEA Board of Governors statement that it liked. It both mentioned all of Tehran's failings and international concern, But then it also had a sentence or two on Iran, some Iran reaching back to the IAEA, trying to deal with inspectors, suggesting that maybe they're turning the corner on it now. And on the sanctions, again, in a sense, Russia can have its cake and eat it too. It would prefer that all these sanctions be approved in the Security Council and therefore subject to Russian vetoes. But on the whole subject of sanctions against Iran, we've had so many rounds of non-Security Council sanctions, unilateral national sanctions, that Russia has got used to it. And I think it just uses them, it points at them when it deals with Iran to say, listen, you're just asking for it. This stuff's not going to stop. So come play ball, fess up, work with the IAEA.
Let me take two more questions quickly. You had Garrett at the front and this young gentleman back here. And I'm sorry to everyone else because we'll have to move into the lunch. And then we'll come back quickly to the panel.
Thanks. Garrett Mitchell, and I write the Mitchell Report. And I want to ask the question this way. Shortly, we're going to hear from the National Security Advisor for the Obama administration, who's going to come spend an hour here. Presumably, if the subject of today's meeting had been what to do about New Zealand, he wouldn't be sparing an hour to
Did
do that.
Did we miss something on New Zealand that happened?
Perhaps he'll talk about it. So one can assume that On Mr. Donilon's short list, his A list, Iran is right up near the top. And what I want to ask you is, if we imagine that every Monday morning at 7 a.m. Greenwich Mean Time, his counterparts in Russia, China, France, and Germany held a five-minute phone conversation to compare their short lists. The three or four things that I worry about every day and most nights. First part of the question is Iran on everybody's list, short list or not? And B, what are those three or four things I worry about every day?
Well, that's very similar to a question we had on the other panel about whether the U.S. and Israel were kind of overreacting when I didn't think we ever quite got a definitive answer to that. And there was a young gentleman here, please, if you could just introduce yourself and ask a question too. Thanks.
My name is Sergio Ceballos. My question was about China. China plays a very important role, and especially you pointed out the relationship, the strong or the robust relationship it has with Tehran as far as their economic relationship goes, but it also has an economic relationship with Israel. I don't know, I don't think it's as robust as it is with the U.S., but why hasn't China played a stronger role in negotiating, in being a major negotiator with Israel and Tehran, given that they're more rational and more neutral in this situation?
Thanks. That's actually a very good question more broadly, perhaps, that you could play this out into the Middle East. China has important interests, not just in energy from Iran itself, but from the Gulf more broadly as well. And China also has relationships not just with Israel, but with Saudi Arabia and other countries. So perhaps, you know, when you answer that question, you can think a little bit more about how China factors in those broader relationships, because I think it's something that people find somewhat puzzling here. So if we could turn to all of you on the panel now, you can also give other thoughts of things that you felt you might not have been able to get across, and then we'll wrap up for the lunch. So Yun, on this question of China.
First of all, on the on your question as for whether what are the three, four top priorities for Chinese national security advisor, well, China doesn't have a national security advisor, but if on their top of the list, first of all, it's always domestic issue. Domestic issue is always more important than foreign policy issues unless there is going to be an imminent war on Chinese border. And for foreign policy, the top priority for Chinese national security decision-making team is always the United States. It's U.S., U.S., and U.S. So, for example, in the past 2 weeks, China has been immersed or completely absorbed into this U.S. plan in East Asia and in Southeast Asia. So the TPP proposed by the United States is regarded as a U.S. conspiracy to replace China's economic leadership in the region. And what the U.S. is doing with ASEAN countries, with on APEC and on EAI, they were seeing as the U.S. trying to consolidate its relations with both maritime ASEAN countries and continental ASEAN countries to come back to the Southeast Asia and to encircle and contain China. So I would say that the U.S. is always China's national security priority. On the issue of why China hasn't played a bigger role in the mediation between Israel and Iran, well, first of all, China, for the longest term, even since, longest term must be too long, was starting from the reform and opening up, and especially in the past decade, China doesn't see itself as a global power. China sees itself as a regional power, and gradually China's developing this global reach. But of course, then we have seen that China is having all sorts of problems in this global engagement in Africa, in Southeast Asia, and in other continents as well. So for China, its priority, first of all, is domestic, and secondly, is China's periphery. And of course, U.S. is always an important issue. But in terms of Middle East, although China regards Middle East as its grand periphery, it's not China's core national security interest. So that explains why China doesn't want to get too involved in the Middle East struggling, because China wants to keep its neutral and outsider role rather than get its hand dirty. If it does get into the negotiation between Israel and Iran, like you pointed out, China has economic and political relations with both countries, then how is China going to pick a side? So for China, the best strategy is to let's leave the mess to the United States and Western countries who would love to get involved in this whole mess. And we will quietly develop and reinforce our economic and political relations with all the countries in the region. So that for China is a strategic choice.
And did any of the events of the Arab Spring, like Libya, for example, really change that? Because, I mean, obviously China tried to stay away from the fray, but also got criticism for not, you know, making a decision.
China certainly, well, the impact of Arab Spring on Chinese government, first of all, is on domestic politics, whether the Arab Spring is going to spread into China, and China also had the Jasmine demonstration in Beijing, which raised quite some headaches with the Chinese senior leaders. But in general, the case of Libya certainly taught China a lesson that China will have to at least think about developing better relations with the oppositions in these countries, because the domestic politics in these countries are so unpredictable. And if China always picks a side with the government, like in the Libya's case, China always sided with Gaddafi, then someday when there is a change of government within the country, then China's national interests cannot be protected. So China's approach and perception and lessons learned from the Libya case is on how to have better relations with different factions, different political players within a certain country, but not necessarily on a broader regional perspective.
That's great, thanks. Francois?
On China, I agree. China is, when I discussed with my Chinese colleagues in the UN, they always say, hey, the interests of China are better served by remaining apolitical. We don't want to be involved in the mess of having to take side, and this is for an issue which is not at the core of our interest. On the South Chinese Sea, yes, they say this is our vital interest. On the Middle East, no. And they always made the parallel with North Korea, indeed saying North Korea is our neighborhood. We have a border with them. We have to be in the six-party talks, and we have to be leading the approach of international community on that. On Iran, it's up to Russia and NATO, which have borders with Iran, to be in the lead and not to us. This is I think, a very clear and self-understandable concept. on what is in the mind of the European leaders. I can speak only for Lady Ashton. You spoke about foreign ministers. But the issues which has been always at the top of his preoccupation is still the Middle East peace process, because it's probably the most difficult issue, and an issue where the European Union and Lady Ashton, as you know, as member of the quartet, has a specific responsibility vis-à-vis the international community. Then, you know, and why? Because for us, it's a neighborhood issue. It's not a, it's a key issue as for you because of Israel and Arab world, but it's also a neighboring issue for us. So we have, there is a specific aspect into that, that Cyprus has sea borders with the region. After that, I think probably, or even before that at this time, you know, we shall have an EU-US summit next week. The main issue will be the economy and the economy and the economy. if we have time, Middle East peace process, probably relation with China and Russia, because China for economy and Russia for strategic reasons are of specific interest for us, Europeans, and after that maybe Iran, yes, but only after.
John.
In Moscow, I don't think it's on its own in the short list that he or she would look at first thing in the morning. But I think it's our interest in Iran and Israel's interest in Iran and the European powers' interest in Iran that continually bumps the problem up several notches in the list of priorities of issues that Moscow has to worry about. In general, also, I would like to make the point that in Moscow, it used to be they thought that the problem in dealing with Iran was the conflict between the U.S. And Iran, that we just couldn't sort it out. But especially over the Ahmadinejad years, most analysts in Moscow think the problem is in Tehran itself, in the nature of Iranian domestic politics. There's just no way to get a consensus to do a deal with the West at this time, given the viciousness of the politics in Tehran. And Ahmadinejad has tried once or twice to run with the ball, and he's basically been cut off at the knees by all of his opponents within the various factions on his right and his left in Tehran.
So Russia doesn't necessarily blame the U.S. solely for this at this point?
No.
My conclusion. Not at all.
Well,
then that's certainly something to work with. Well, I think we'd better conclude this panel so you can all grab some lunch and get back to your seats by... well, we've got half an hour now to grab the sandwich. I know you're all rushing at once, but thank you very much, and we'll see you back here.